One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hey, Guy. How are you?
Good. Very, very excited about this one. Big one. Man who produced that record.
Yes, Shell, tell me. The My Generation record. But of course, he kicked off with You Really Got Me with the Kinks and sort of set the template for a particular sound of beat groups and certainly of distorted guitar riffs.
Yeah, and actually a band who weren't that big, The Creation, but who actually shaped the 90s. Guitar band sound.
Yeah, like the Oasis and bands like that, of course.
Yeah.
So just to tell our audience, in case you don't know who Shell Talmy is, You Really Got Me, All the Day, All the Night, Tired of Waiting for You, Set Me Free, A Well-Respected Man, Dedicated Follower of Fashion, Sunny Afternoon, Dead End Street, I Can't Explain Anyway. I mean, you know, he produced all of these. We wouldn't be here, Guy, would we?
No, it's true. It's true. And when we want to find where he went. I'm very, very excited. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them, and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
There you go.
There we are.
Shell, you're looking very cool. What a pleasure to meet you, sir.
I apologize in advance for my allergy voice, because this has been the worst allergy season in LA's history that I'm aware of. So I'm very healthy except for my allergy. Anyways,
great.
Nice
great.
To talk to you guys. Okay.
Shell, I'm Gary. Yeah. This is Guy. Where are you? Where are you, Shell? Whereabouts are you?
Where in LA? Studio City.
Yeah.
You know, Studio City.
Yeah. I used to live in LA for a few years.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. No, we have a house here on Studio City. We lived in the hills for 20 or more years. Jan is a major gardener, so we finally got a house with a huge spot for her to do her gardening.
Beautiful.
So.
Shell, absolute privilege to have you on. You created, really, for us guys, the sound of British pop music.
Well, thank you for that. I'm not sure that's totally accurate, but I certainly did my best coming from LA, where, you know, I think you know I started out as a recording engineer, and I spent a lot of time at the studio figuring out how to mic various instruments, how to isolate them, and all that kind of stuff. So that's what I actually brought with me to London when I went. And it looks like it paid off, which is nice.
Well, you were the first person to use tons of microphones on the drums.
Yes. Yeah, because I always wanted control of every piece of drum equipment. And at that point in time, both there and here, everybody was using like three or four mics. I thought that's really not good enough. So I worked out how to use 12 without them phasing, which is what the first thing I was told when I brought it to London was that you can't do that because all the mics will phase. I said, well, I guess you just have to listen. So, you know, a month later, everybody was trying to use 12 mics.
But it's true what Guy says. I mean, your drum sound, you know, on people like Keith Moon was incredible. I mean, you look at a track by The Creation, like, how does it feel?
Yeah.
I mean, that drum kit, I mean, Jimmy Page could only have dreamt of that later on. No drums had ever sounded like this before.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that because I was always very intent on getting the best possible sounds I could get. And if I succeeded, then I'm extremely pleased.
These were tiny desks back then, right? We're talking about sort of three, if you were lucky, four-track machines.
Comparatively speaking, yeah, sure.
I don't want to get too technical for our listeners, but just having enough the channels to put all those mics in must have been a challenge.
The studio I was in had a method of chaining another bunch of inputs so that, you know, we're able to get all that together.
Right.
What was the beginning for you, Shell, getting into being an engineer? What encouraged you to do that? Were you a musician? Because I know you've written some songs.
No, I'm not. I play guitar, but I'm a good enough producer not to ever want to record myself as a guitarist. I guess it goes back to when I was 13, and I think it's fair to say a smart-ass kid in school, and a teacher sent in...
Sorry, if I can stop you there. You were appearing on a quiz show when you were a kid, right?
Yes, it was called The Quiz Kids, right. And I loved the whole idea of it, but even then I wanted to be behind the camera instead of in front of it. But that was the turning point for me in terms of selecting showbiz as a career.
Because just to follow up on that, you've got one of this incredible high IQ, haven't you, Shell? You're part of a group of people above the 99.9 percentile of the rest of the human race.
They're called the 999 Society. And it is a high IQ organization. And I find it extremely interesting to be part of it. And the members are all separated truly around the world. So very seldom do we ever get together and meet each other. It's all usually by either email or, I guess, Zoom now, although I haven't done that yet.
Are you sort of like the Avengers? Do you sort of look down on the rest of we poor humans?
I have never looked down on anybody who did not deserve to have to be looked down upon.
So there's a story about you coming to England with a load of records of acetates that you didn't actually produce and being told, is that true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Actually, it was only two acetates. My friend Nick Vinay was A&R at Capitol Records, and I told him I was going for 5 weeks, which was my intention, to London so I could see some of that and some of Paris before life passed me by. And I said, it'd be nice if I could work for a couple of weeks, so they didn't have a whole lot of money. And he said, here, take my acetates and tell them you did them.
One of those was the Beach Boys, right? I
mean, that's a Beach Boys, record. Yes, Serpent Safari by the Beach Boys, and Lou Rawls, the name of which now escapes me. But anyway, two great records. And when I met with Dick Rowe at the Decca, after hearing him, he said, you start today. So so that's how all that came about.
What music was going on at that time? I mean, because we've got to try and find the landscape of music before You Really Got Me came along. You know, the sound of pop, what was inspiring you and what were you hating?
I think I got inspired by R&B early-ish on when I heard G by the Crows, and that kind of put me in the right direction of things I wanted to hear. And I listened to a lot of music on the radio at that point in time. Or you might remember, since you lived in L.A., there was a place here called Music City that had a bunch of booths, and you could go visit the booths and take out records and listen to them before you bought them. Well, I used to go out and listen to them and then buy them. But I didn't have any, you know, this was a kid at that point. I've always been interested in music. I've always liked music. I used to buy a kind of a crummy little weekly, you want to call it newspaper. It just really wasn't. Was on the worst kind of paper, but they had lyrics printed to all the songs. I probably seriously know lyrics to hundreds of songs because of that.
I suppose the Beatles were beginning to happen, and that was beginning to, the sound of British beat music was filtering through to you.
Well, the Beatles didn't really get started until I got to London. In fact, I've always said that if I had gone 2 months before I actually got there, that maybe I would have been at Decca when they appeared and were turned down. And because I certainly wouldn't have turned them down. I heard the acetate of what was played when they went to go see Dick Rowe at Decca. And
Dick Rowe famously turned down the Beatles, didn't he?
Well, but, which is not true. It really was. That's a bad rap.
Okay.
He did not turn it down. He had his number one A&R guy. It gave him the choice between the Beatles and I forgot the other name of the other band now, who he chose, and had a couple of, you know, small hits, but nothing like the Beatles. So it was not Dick Rowe's fault.
What was the first big record that you produced? You got him to do The Bachelors, didn't you, at the beginning?
The Bachelors was the first one, yeah. I think in retrospect, they're probably testing me in that they gave me three Irish harmonica players, which is what they were and was how they had appeared prior to them signing with Decca and me getting them. And so I had to rehearse them. I had a little tiny flat in London and rehearsed them in my flat for 5 or 6 weeks and chose who was going to be the lead singer and how they should do harmonies and all that kind of stuff. And then the first session we did was Charmaine.
Yeah.
And I did it at Olympic and it took no time at all because we were well rehearsed. And I said to Keith, I think what I just did, I kind of hate because it's pseudo country music. But little did I know.
So what,
anyways,
what was a producer in your mind? What at that point, you know, was it someone who suggested musical arrangements? Because like George Martin?
No. I the studio I worked for was Conway Studio here. It was the original Conway Studios. And Julian was English, by the way, owned the studio. And he had worked at IBC. And when we discussed producing, and I always had an impression that a producer should be a hands-on producer, which is what I chose to be and which I still am. And that I'm really there from beginning, you know, choosing the artist, choosing the material, working out the arrangements with the band, continuing through, you know, to, you know, mixes and mastering. So apparently what I know for a fact from some of the people I speak to, it's kind of a dying art to be a hands-on producer. There's a lot of producers who think that checking in once a week is really the cool thing to do. I don't look at it that way.
We have to talk about the Kinks because this is your first sort of major record. But and there's so much myth and legend that surrounds that first single, You Really Got Me, and especially in the guitar sound. But was this a band that was presented to you or did you go and see them live? And what were they like?
No, I was actually in Denmark Street visiting some publisher friends of mine. We were going to have lunch. And
Tin Pan Alley, as it was known.
Yes, Tin Pan Alley, right.
Yeah.
And Robert Wace, one of the managers, walked in with an acetate of the Kinks. And I was in the lobby and he said, anybody here would like to listen to this? And I said, well, I'm here, I'll listen. So I did. And liked a lot about what I heard. And eventually I took them into Pi and got them signed.
I understand You Really Got Me was a very different version because Ray wrote it on the piano, didn't he?
He wrote most everything on the piano, yeah. At least originally. I think he did switch off from time to time, but he wrote stuff at home. So I wasn't privy to how he went about it, but mainly piano, I think, is what he used.
But what's interesting is that for someone who's known for this incredible catalogue of fabulously whimsical sort of pastoral songwriting, that he basically invented heavy rock as we know it with this sort of little batch of songs.
I don't think he started out thinking that way, or did I? The fact that it turned out that way was, I think, a surprise for all of us. And the fact that it's continued to last is also a very nice surprise.
So do you think much of that could have been to do with you, Shell, knowingly or unknowingly?
Well, I got to figure that I had a damn good part of it. I mean, yes, I was the producer. I was a hands-on producer. I had worked out how to do drums and lots of other sounds, including guitars. And so I guess, I'm as responsible as Ray is for writing a great song.
But I guess that's guitar sound, which is seminal now. You know, the Dave Davis guitar sound, right. Which, you know, the fifths, you know, you can follow the seam that goes on from there through punk and through all kinds of heavy rock and Oasis, 90s, whatever.
Well, the torn speakers, wasn't it? That was the
thing. Sound, we are told, through myth, it was where the speakers were slashed.
Yeah.
Were you in the room when those speakers got slashed? And tell me the truth. What is the real story?
It was, I think it was called an El Pico amp. And not only was it slashed, but David definitely suggested that as we walk by, we could give it a kick or two. So it developed its own sound. And I did chain it to an AC-30.
Ah.
And
you like your chaining, don't you?
And Yes. Well, if it works, yeah.
Was that the first distorted guitar sound on record? Can we just have that as a definitive yes or no?
A lot of people say it is. I can't comment one way or the other. I don't know. It's certainly among the first, let's put it that way.
And, of course, there's the question of the other musicians who were there.
The other musicians who also were terrific, yes. Yeah.
We know he didn't do the solo. We know he didn't do the solo. We know that. We're not going to ask
Jimmy Page question. We're talking about,
Page
right?
Page finally admitted that he didn't do the solo. Why he even said he never did, I've never understood. In fact, he wasn't even on that session. So I employed him for the album because Ray wanted to concentrate on singing and not playing rhythm guitar. So I employed him as a rhythm guitarist for the album.
Okay, we're just going to hold there for a second because I think, you are the touchstone here. You've got Ray Davies and Jimmy Page in the room. No one knows who Jimmy Page is really outside of the studio world. What was Jimmy like as the session player?
Oh, Jimmy was great. No, I found him when he was about 17 and he didn't read music then. So, I mean, my early memories of him when I booked him on sessions was in between takes, he was practicing how to read music. So he's an extraordinary guitarist, no question.
Do you know what? I had a funny thing. I worked with Jimmy many times over the years, but I did a project with him with David Coverdale. And when we were rehearsing for the shows, we did all these Zeppelin songs and all their songs. And then there was going to be a load of Whitesnake stuff. And I remember thinking, how the hell is Jimmy going to learn all this stuff? And of course he had it in a second, because of course he's the session dog. And it was, it's never leaves you.
he was very quick.
Just while we're on Jimmy, and I know we'll come back to Jimmy later when we do talk about The Who. Everyone thinks that Jimmy was the first guy to pick up a bow and to bow the guitar. But actually, it was...
He didn't do that. He didn't do that either.
It was Eddie Phillips, right?
That's Eddie Phillips, absolutely.
From The Creation.
Yeah. And Jimmy... No, I won't use the word stole. Let's say borrowed. And he started using it.
All artists steal, don't they? Don't they say average artists borrow, great artists steal?
Yes, of course, of course. But was Jimmy in the room when Eddie Phillips from The Creation was bowing away one day? And when?
No, he wasn't on those sessions at all.
All right. They're great records, by the way, The Creation. I know that comes up a little bit later. But I mean, Making Time and Painter Man, I mean, they're just, I mean, as Guy was saying to me earlier, this is the 90s. Oasis wouldn't have existed, would they, Guy?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But in fact, Alan McGee named his label after them.
They were one of my very favorite bands. And my major regret is that right after I made a deal with Ahmet Erdogan at Atlantic to sign them for Atlantic, to make them the superstars they deserved to be, they broke up and I could not keep them together.
Wow.
So, but there you go.
But what was Ray like? And how was your... Because Ray is, he's famously difficult. Everyone knows that. And Dave and Ray don't get on very well. And I think Dave was furious for a long time that Ray said he was there when he was inspirational in slashing those speakers and whatever. But how was it for you dealing with very difficult, at times, sensitive artists?
Well, I think I treated each one like that as well as I could because they all differed from each other. Ray could certainly be difficult. Basically, I really never had a problem with him while recording. When he and Dave would get at it on a session, I'd take all the other guys and we'd go out to have some coffee, so... come back when hopefully there wasn't a lot of blood to clean up. So Ray was fine. Ray is notional, I think, is maybe the best way to put it. Depends what kind of mood he's in.
That's a brilliant word.
He can be he could be really good and he could be just the opposite.
Is it time for The Who?
Well, I think I just want to keep on a little bit on Kinks. I'll tell you why, because there's a famous track called See My Friends. And I was listening to that this afternoon, and I noticed that some people have said that this was the first use of Indian style music ever in pop music. I mean, this is before George Harrison.
Oh, definitely before the Beatles. Yeah, as far as I know, it's the first one. Yeah. The influence was that I was recording John Mark, who became part of the Mark Almond band, and John was a great guitarist and excellent songwriter. Wrote a song called Baby, I Got a Long Way to Go, which was Indian influenced because he had been there and he liked the music and all that kind of stuff. And I said, would you mind if I played it for Ray? And he said, no problem. So I did. And like pretty much the next day, Ray came back with See My Friends. And we did not have a sitar, so we detuned his guitar, Dave's guitar. And that's why we got it as close as we could come to a sitar at the time. There was no sitar players that I knew in London.
This is an amazing guy, isn't it? I mean, because not only has Shell developed the sort of distorted guitar sound, which is one, you know, whatever the argument is, you know, people can tweet us or whatever and tell us that it's something else. But that really was the first heavy rock sound on a guitar.
But the Indian thing's interesting because it was clearly in the water. Because I'm wondering how close to this time was Jeff Beck with the Yardbirds? Because he was getting a sitar sound as well.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. You're going to have to research because I really don't know.
Yeah. And then Dan Electro came out with their electric sitar really quickly. There was clearly something going on, wasn't there?
I think it's after that. I think the Jeff Beck.
Oh, no, it is after that. Absolutely. I'm not trying to take anything away from Shell here, but I'm just saying it was it became such a thing.
Apparently, yeah. Well, it was yet another new trend that expanded, you know, kind of like, I mean, not much later because of the fact that I did, you know, Pentangle and Roy Harper, and you know, all of the folk stuff started big time after that as well. Prior to that, it was pretty much in the back. Eventually, it picked up from where it was in the U.S. because in the U.S. in the mid '50s, folk was really big, and you know, took another 10 years or more before it actually caught on in England, I gather.
You're right, and it's very connected, isn't it? Because that use of drones and obviously there was Joe Boyd came along. We're jumping a little bit, but Joe Boyd and the Incredible String Band and what was coming out of, you know, the folk revival that was beginning mixed up with psychedelia.
That happened in the late 60s as opposed to, you know, a hell of a lot earlier.
But just, you know, going on to your folk stuff, you know, that was, you know, for you to end up doing Pentangle and Roy Harper, that was the right move to make at that point.
Oh, absolutely. No, and I loved recording the Pentangle. They're one of the best bands musically I'd ever recorded. Every one of them was individually a soloist and a star in their own right. And the fact they all came together for Pentangle was brilliant.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. That's drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. Check it out.
We have jumped ahead here because, Gary, wasn't there some more kink stuff you wanted to address?
Well, you know, I think what I really wanted to ask you, Shell, is to talk a little bit about Ray's songwriting, because towards the end of your spell with Ray, you know, we move into Dedicated Follower, Sunny Afternoon, Dead End Street. I mean, you were witnessing this guy's songwriting just becoming bigger and bigger. You know, so there's that to talk about. I also find extraordinary that in a way, a band like The Who came along and Pete Townshend and completely stole the thunder off the Kinks.
Ray's songwriting has been phenomenal pretty much throughout, yeah. No question.
Yeah.
By the way, I think what you're intimating with what you said about his later song, like Sunny Afternoon, was that there was a different type of softer music than You Really Got Me. That really started with Tired of Waiting for You, which was the third single. I pulled out of it being only included in an album and said, this has got to be a single. And of course, it went to number one, which is great. So, but that was the first of Ray's songs that really got known by, you know, worldwide and by the fans. And it was the beginning of what he finally wound up doing with Waterloo Sunset and Sunday Afternoon, you know, all those other things.
So quintessentially English as well.
Yes, I always said he was the commentator for England in terms of writing about everything that was happening in England, the good and the bad.
I love what, because Pete Townshend has his description of him is, he said, I worship, no, I exalt Ray Davies
well,
as a songwriter.
And good for him. You know, Pete is a good guy, and he does acknowledge the fact that there are other people in the world besides him, and his band, and which is also very nice. And, you know, Ray certainly was one of the leading ever people, songwriters, who broke new ground.
Yeah. Now, I'm afraid that does seem to be the perfect segue, because I now want to ask, because apparently Pete wrote I Can't Explain as a direct sort of rip of You Really Got Me, so that in the hope that you would produce The Who.
Well, I don't think it was off of You Really Got Me, but it was.
Oh, no.
You know, that's not what I was told, but was told because by that time I'd already done several other things with the Kinks. He did write something that he thought was a la the Kinks in enough ways to get my attention, and he was absolutely correct.
How did the meeting go about between you?
Again, this is, you know, a backstory here. I had a lady working for me who was friendly with the managers, you know, Stamp and the other guy. I don't want to even mention his name. And
Kit Lambert.
Right. You don't want to ask me about him. Anyways.
Don't we?
She was asked to ask me if I'd come and see the band. So I said, yeah, of course. I was on the lookout for artists. So I went to see them at a church hall, which is where apparently where they had been rehearsing. And I walked in there, and the first thing they played was I'm a Man. And I think I heard about 8 bars. I said, fine, I'll sign you.
So what interests me with these bands back then, when everything's such a new world, Shell, is that I think I can speak for Gary here, is that when we first went into a studio, we'd had years of reading about it and studying it and had an idea of kind of what to expect from going into a studio. And so even though you're new and fresh and get everything wrong, still you know what you're building up to. With these guys, especially, you know, coming from just these high-energy pub gigs, it's like, how did they adapt to this environment, which was a new environment for everyone?
I think the answer is extremely well. They had been doing enough gigs, so they were not shy about trying new things. And they certainly had been playing at various clubs and all that kind of thing. And I'm assuming I know for a fact they already had a ton of fans that they built up by playing gigs. So being in the studio was no big deal. They knew about studios. I presume, and I don't know this, that they had visited studios, so it was not a totally foreign environment for him.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, they'd done I'm the Face.
Right. Well, did Pete have a studio at home then? Did he have
he
demos?
He did, yeah. No, he had a small studio at home, right. He did, yeah.
Because I've got to say, Chell, and I'll say this now, is that the records you produced for The Who are the best sounding records they made all the way up to Who's Next. It's like they fell off a cliff when you went sonically, I think.
Thank you. I totally agree with you. And the reason why, as I think most people by now know, and if they don't, I'll repeat quickly, it's all because of good old Lambert, who was jealous of the fact that I was having influence with, as he put it, his voice, quote unquote. And I got a letter in the mail saying my contract was null and void, which I have to say pissed me off. And I sued. Of course, I won, but I was unable to ever record him again.
Wow. Wow. Well, before we get to that rude moment, we need to talk about the beginning with The Who, right, Guy?
Yeah, I mean, well, I want to know about the actual sessions or no comics. But actually, more importantly, let's just get to the big one. My Generation, the actual recording of My Generation.
Well, okay, I'd already started with Pete on his sounds of distortion and all that kind of stuff. So before Generation, because we'd already started with Anyhow, Anyway, Anywhere.
Which is that the first proper feedback on a record?
Yeah, I think so. I believe so. If not the first, it's among the first. In any event, before Generation, which was the next session that I did after Anyhow, Anyway, Anywhere, I spent about 3 or 4 hours with just Pete in the studio doing various mics and various distances and all that kind of stuff, so that I was about 95% sure I knew exactly how to mic his guitar so we'd get, you know, the ultimate in terms of the sound we were looking for.
Right. And then, and also, because apparently there's some notes of Pete's, because the one thing that always got me, because you've got one of the most radical, revolutionary punk rock things ever to happen, which is the first bass solo on a pop record.
That's true, yeah.
Well, the one thing that never comes up is whose idea is that? And then until recently, I came across that someone said there was, Pete had written notes for how the song was meant to go, and it just said, John Bass Stuff.
Yes, I think that's exactly the way it went. And John was, of course, an extremely good bass player, and he was an exhibitionist as well.
I'd argue that Substitute is a bass solo as well. I mean, I don't know how you let him get away with, where there's this sort of instrumental verse, right, and he clearly just turns the bass up, and it's a bass solo.
Yeah.
Did you do a Substitute show?
Yes, I did. And no, they say I didn't, but I did.
And the other thing, sorry, back to My Generation, is it's the Ivy League singers?
Yes, is it? Yeah.
Who were they?
No, I can't explain.
The Ivy League was for that.
Because the BVs of My Generation do sound like accomplished pop backing vocals and almost a bit incongruous.
I definitely say about Townsend, he was very smart, and they were pissed off that I used the Ivy League for backing vocals because they were capable of doing it. They went out and learned how to do backing vocals. That's how that came about.
But who were they, Shel?
Well, Perry Ford, and I forget the other two guys' names. But they were an established trio, had hits of their own, and did terrific harmonies.
So the question that I think we need to bring up Jimmy Page again, because I think Roger Daltrey was doing some interviews recently saying it was Jimmy that had played the guitar solo on I Can't Explain. I think he said it was I Can't Explain. What's the truth, Shell?
He was not on I Can't Explain.
Didn't he just play on the B-side? He just played on Bald Headed Woman, didn't he?
Yeah, he was on the other track I did, not on that one.
Are you right?
Because the old story I heard that was that Pete wouldn't let Jimmy play his 12 string, and so Jimmy wouldn't let Pete use his fuzz box, or the other way around.
You know, if all that is true, then I honestly don't know about it. All I can tell you is that what I wanted to happen as who played what happens. What I've always tried to do with any band is I always rehearsed, I've always worked out the arrangements with the band so that when we'd go into the studio, I would be shooting for knowing about 90% about what was going to happen and leaving 10% for something spontaneous that would be wonderful.
Right.
And I've done that from the get-go, and I certainly did it with The Who.
I just think what must have been tricky for you as a producer is these massive players. These players who are such big personalities. Like, you've got John, who's, you know, unstoppable bass playing, and then Pete, obviously, and Keith. I mean, how...
That was exactly
how
I was
it recording Keith Moon and containing him, even?
Keith actually was my favorite guy out of the movie. He was terrific. He was a character, to say the least, and still, in my opinion, was the best ever rock drummer of all time.
But he was a child
He was
16, 17.
He played his butt off. No, my story I've told several times about Mooney is that, you know, how wild he was when he was playing. And so we talked about it, started miking drums with 12 mics.
Yeah.
And I went up to Mooney. I said, please do me a favor. These mics are really expensive. I don't care how close you get. Don't effing hit them. And he said, no problem. And he never did. He came within a millimeter or two, but he never hit a mic.
Because what's extraordinary about Moon, which people don't get, is that for someone who was so just nuts and played the drums back to front, basically, where everyone else was the, you know, Pete was the rhythm section.
Yeah, totally. No question about it. Yeah, he was brilliant.
But Keith's actual timekeeping was incredible. His actual strictness of tempo.
He was a great drummer.
It's John who used to rush ahead, not
no,
Keith.
No, not at all. No, Keith was a great drummer. No doubt about it. That's why I keep saying it. He was the best rock drummer I've ever heard.
Did My Generation sort of come fully formed to your ears when they first played it, and you were wherever you were you in a rehearsal room, church hall, whatever it was? Was that the energy?
As you already said, Pete had a studio in his house. He came with a demo that he'd done of it, and which is, you know, a rough demo. But I heard it, said, that's great. By all means, let's get that done properly. And do the arrangements for it and all that kind of stuff. And that, so I then, you know, went on to my usual thing of rehearsing and doing arrangements.
Also, because the things like, I mean, had it been done for the fact that My Generation changes key every verse, goes up a tone every verse. Was that really radical? Is that something that had been done before? Or?
I think the answer is yes. I mean, we're talking about things modulating. Yeah, I can think of a lot of old songs that, if they had some time, to even tell you what songs they were, but I don't.
This is amazing that we can go on so long about one song, but it's such a seminal piece of work, and it's affected us all, and it's still, you know...
Perfectly understandable why he's going on about this one song, because it's a complete surprise to us that, certainly to me in any event, that My Generation became an anthem. You know, that's not something you even think about preparing. You know, they say, oh, yeah, I'm going to record something, it's going to be an anthem. You know, yes.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine if you knew when you were in recording it that people were going to be still listening to it 60 years later?
That did not cross my mind. I thought it was going to last, but not 60 years.
I just want to ask about the famous stuttering that Roger does.
I can tell you about that. That was during rehearsal, and he did it as a joke. I said, you know what? Let's leave that in. Just for the hell of it. Of course, the BBC banned it.
But how long was it banned for? It couldn't have been.
Until it became number one or something like that, I think. You know,
it never got to number one. It only got to number two.
Number two. You're quite right.
It's quite funny, isn't it? Because it's literally one of the 10 most important records in pop history. And it never
But I don't think
one.
Who have ever had a number one single, have they?
No, they haven't. They've never had a number one single. That's actually that's the highest single they've ever had.
Extraordinary.
Right, I think you're right. Yes.
We should move on to another great artist, because you were briefly at the very beginning of David Bowie's career, weren't you, when he was in the Mannish Boys?
David Bowie was brought to me by a good friend of mine who had found him and to my office. He was 17.
Who's a good friend? Will we know him?
I can think of his name. I'll tell you. his name was Leslie Kahn, and he was a fringe music biz guy and a kind of a hustler and all that kind of stuff. But he managed a couple of people here and there. He found David and brought him in to me in the office, because he couldn't do anything with him recording-wise. So I liked David immediately, because he was brash, reminded me of me when I turned up, and it was brash on purpose, but he was brash and he was very smart. And I heard a couple of things that he did, and I said, you know, this is great. Yeah, let's go record.
Because he did I Pity the Fool with you, didn't he? Which is...
He did, yeah.
And was that something he suggested or you?
You know, I can't remember who suggested it. One of us
Where
did.
Was your office, Shell? Where was your office? I'm trying to picture Bowie walking along the street as this.
My office was in Greek Street.
Oh, right, right. So he may well have gone for that coffee in Denmark Street in that famous coffee bar just before he came to see you.
Oh, the two eyes you're talking about?
No, there's one that's still there now.
Oh, in Denmark Street.
Oh, the Bar Italia.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay,
one in there. It's an Italian name because there's a famous bit of footage that's come out of him walking into this place in Denmark Street recently when he was 17.
I'm sure he did, yeah.
What's interesting about this whole time and the way you operated, Shell, which is the way that Gary and I know record producers is someone's like, you're signed to a record label and then there's a producer who wants to produce you or you want to use this producer. You were like what a movie producer is in that you find an act, you take them to a label, you get them to sign them and you produce them. And it's much more kind of Svengali-ish.
I'd like to call it hands-on. I mean,
hands-on, yeah. I don't mean it in a bad way. I just mean
I try not to be Svengali. Back in the day, you're talking about which I was an independent producer.
Yeah.
I did not rely on somebody going and finding a deal for me. I had to go do the deals myself or find the deals myself. So that's what I did. That's what happened.
So, for instance, would that mean that the Who had a record deal because you were going to produce them?
No, it meant that I was going to go find them a record deal after
that. That's what I mean. So does that mean you had to put up the money?
I spend my own money, yes.
Whoa.
Right, I see. Wow. So you really were at the beginning.
That's proper producer, yeah. Record producer, as we know it now, is actually really more technically record director. They don't find the money.
Yeah, there's a lot of record directors, probably a good way to describe them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of so-called producers now that check in once a week with whatever project they're involved in, lie down on the couch for a half hour and then leave. I don't get that, and I don't understand that, and I don't think that that's proper to call themselves producers, quite frankly, but that's my take on it.
I don't know if I'm getting everything in chronological order, but I do know you made a very significant record in David Bowie's life because he put together this great album, Pinups.
He did Friday in My Mind.
My Mind, which was he said it was one of the great records that when he was a kid influenced them as a mod. And of course, you did the original Easy Beats, the Australian band, the Easy Beats. Tell us a little bit about that, Shell.
Yeah, because that's an amazing song. That's an incredibly complex, beautiful piece of work.
The Easy Beats were obviously Australian, I'm sure you know. They had become in many ways the Australian Beatles, and they really had that kind of notoriety in Australia. Can we just break here while I get Jan to shut the freaking dogs up?
Keep that in.
He's finally doing that. Okay. They were managed by a guy named Ted Albert, who was one of those thank you, Dad situations. His daddy and had one of the oldest and biggest publishing companies in Australia. So he started a quote-unquote producing. In any event, the songs that they did in Australia would not have gone down in England, but they were absolutely, the band was huge in Australia. And I said, you know, including the fact that they had screaming a la the Beatles and various items of apparel tossed up on the stage, you know, like the Beatles did. Oh, female apparel, I should have said. And, you know, they were huge. Anyways, they were then brought to England. Now, their manager was a guy named Mike Vaughan, who was a very nice guy. He was actually started out as a real estate agent, but, you know, wild about music. He heard them first and became their manager, and he's the one that got him assigned to Ted Albert. Anyways, Mike also got him a deal with United Artists. And so now they come to England, and I don't know about them at this point, but I subsequently heard, and know the whole story, is that Albert did several sides producing, quote unquote, with them, and UA, not to put to the final point on it and not to be really ridiculous, said not satisfactory and you're no longer the producer. So
get me Shell Talmy.
Well, then a PR guy I knew apparently suggested that they come and see me, and Mike Vaughan came and saw me. And I said, sure, I'm interested, as I was always interested in bands. I knew of the band. I didn't really heard them. Anyways, they came in. I got on with them extremely well. We're back in Greek Street again at this point. And they played me stuff, and I really liked them. I did not like the songs. I said, what I want you guys to do, I said, I want you to go back and write songs and come up here like every Friday and play me what you've written, and we'll find a song. Well, this went on for like literally 6 weeks, and I kept saying, no, not good enough. and the sixth week, they came in, and the first thing they played me was Friday Night Mine. I said, that's it. We're going in immediately.
I mean, obviously, it's a story about like having a regular job on a Monday and then looking forward to Friday. But it was really, yeah. It was about them trying to write a song for you on the Friday, right?
I knew that. I knew it was a hit song the moment I heard it. I set up a session like the next few days, and we went in and cut the song. And of course, the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah.
Did you have like a particular engineer you were working with, or
I've worked with dozens of different engineers.
Yeah. Because then engineers came with the studio, didn't they?
Basically, yes, they usually did. Yeah. First Friday in my mind, it was Glenn Johns at IBC.
Well, I was wondering actually. I was going to say, who was your competition? And I was going to say, was it Glenn Johns? But actually, Glenn Johns was under you, right?
Well, he was my engineer.
Yeah. So who was your competition? Who was the other guy? Who were you up against?
At that point in time, Glenn was mainly an engineer, and he did start producing not long afterwards. Mickey Most, obviously, and
of course,
Mike Hurst, and who else? Actually, I can't think. Well, I can't think of anybody else.
Because George Martin was doing a very different thing.
George Martin was a company producer, of course, and was not doing the same kind of thing, no.
The other band that I just want to mention as well is because you worked with Manfred Mann, didn't you? And
yes.
Semi-detached suburban Mr. James is a bit of a classic.
Yeah.
That would have been with Mike Dabo, would it? Mike Dabo?
Mike Dabo,
Mike
yeah.
Dabo.
Well, that, again, is a backstory with here. I brought two great bands in to Decca when I was, you know, sort of an independent producer for Decca only. And they turned them both down on me. And I thought, well, I guess it's time for me to become a independent producers. So Manfred went away, of course. They then had Doo Wah Diddy. And then when the lead singer left the band and they thought their life was over and everybody said, you know, Manfred Mann is now going to disappear. And they took on Mike Dabo. So Jerry Braun, the manager, came and saw me and he said, would you like to now produce them independently? I said, absolutely. So that's how we got started. They were then, we went to Philips, or rather, used the studio at Philips. And Philips, I think, signed them. They did, of course. Just Like a Woman was the first Dylan song that we did.
Right.
And Manfred was, and I believe still is, a major Dylan fan. And right after that was Semi-Detached.
Yeah, it's funny with his Dylan thing, because he then went on to be an early supporter of Springsteen, wasn't he? He was kind of ahead of the curve on
that. Yeah, he was. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
When did your time in the UK come to an end, and why, Sheldon?
I left in 1979. I'd been there for 17 years, and quite frankly, by the mid-70s, I was pretty burned out and doing a whole bunch of other different things. And I probably, in fact, definitely should have gone back to LA at that point, but I hung on another 4 or 5 years and came back in 1979.
You were in London when punk happened, and it's your records that were the kind of the blueprint for that. You know, My Generation and You Really Got Me, that's the stuff that was still cool.
Shell did The Damned.
I did a punk band.
Yeah. Oh, of course you did The Damned, didn't you? Sorry.
Yeah, and no, I didn't want to condemn it. I thought, this is, yeah, sure, I will take them on to do one. They're really nice guys. I got on with them extremely well. We did those two sides, and I believe they've become classics, so I'm told.
Yeah, of course. Sorry, I can't believe I missed that.
What was the key track you did?
Sick of Being Sick or something like that, I think it was. Yeah. It was one of them, and yeah. I forget what the other one was called. I mean, you know, we're talking about 50 years here. Give me a break.
What were you coming back to, Shell, when you came back to LA? Did you have a sort of plan?
No, nothing in particular. I just thought it was time to come back. I thought, yeah, I certainly could do more stuff, but I was still kind of burned out. In fact, I was. I came back and I got into things like more to do with books, and I got involved with finance, you know, stock market and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until actually several years later I got back into doing something.
Did you find that people wanted you to do you 10 years before, that you weren't allowed to move on as a producer and explore different sounds? The bands were coming to you now and said, I really want it to sound like you did in the 60s.
Well, I got a lot of that, but I pretty much said, you're going to get what I think is going to be really good. If you want me to do it, then I will do what I do. You know, if you want a specific sound that's a throwback to something, then I'm probably not the guy you want.
Do you still mic up drums the way you used to?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It seems to me, Shell, is that you're a song man. You know, you're a song producer, you know, because you look at your list, look at your CV.
I've said ad nauseum that everything starts with the song. I've also been quoted as saying that a lousy band will have a hit with a great song, but the reverse of that is not true. So a great band with a lousy song, forget it. Not going
to
happen.
I'm talking to our listeners now. You can stay in touch with Shell and see what he's up to. You've got Instagram, haven't you? You're fully social media, Shell. You've got your website.
Facebook in particular. I've been writing vignettes of everybody I've produced and some rock history and items, things that happened during my musical career and all that kind of stuff on Facebook. I've been doing it for a year and a half now. And as a matter of fact, the current one out right now is about the Easy Beats follow-up to Friday in My Mind.
Brilliant.
Do you ever hear from Pete and Ray?
Not really, no. Pete and I communicate every now and then, but not often.
Did your relationship suffer because of the Kit thing?
It's certainly soured, I think is probably a good way to put it. Pete was always cool. I had no problem with him whatsoever. And same thing with Wood Mooney.
Thank you so much for coming on, Shell.
It's my pleasure. But out of curiosity, are you guys still doing gigs, by the way, or not?
We're coming to America next month.
Are you? All right. You coming to L.A.?
We're coming to LA, yes, and we would love to invite you if you've...
Fine. Where are you playing at, you know?
We're playing the Orpheum on the 18th of February.
I can't remember where the Orpheum is. Is that downtown?
We'll get in touch.
Okay. It doesn't matter. If it's in LA, it's 30 miles from wherever anyone is. Everything is.
One thing's for sure, you can't walk, right?
Okay, well, anyways, I'd be delighted to meet you in person and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure we can arrange it.
It's a great honor having you on. You know,
it's
amazing to talk about some of those great records you've made. Thank you, Shell.
And thank you on behalf of the world for your contribution.
Thanks. Very flattering. Thank you.
To be honest, I think on both of our counts, there was a little bit of sort of puppy dog over-enthusiasm.
Yes. I was very excited.
You know, because it was. I mean, come on, man. What's interesting is you sort of think about this and you research it and you go, Shell, tell me. Then you're looking at the guy and you're talking to him, and it's the bloke who produced My Generation.
I know. You know, tunes that defined rock and roll.
Yeah. I mean, you know, no fat on it, mate. What an incredible career. But like I said, I love that he was, you know, the fact that he found the band, he put the money up, he did the whole thing. It was all on him, you know.
Yeah. And I love this little sort of presence, sort of this subversive presence of Jimmy Page creeping in and out around the background, putting his guitar here and a bit of guitar there. And it's still shrouded in mystery. And I think,
Also, it makes me think, you know, it was like there was this little coven of Americans sort of sneaking around, not sneaking around London, but in London, kind of being quite important movers and shakers. There was him, Joe Boyd, Tony Visconti. And from talking to Shell, it's like they were all completely unaware of each other.
Of course. And then I love just the idea of Glyn Johns, you know, just sort of being the sort of T-boy, then the engineer, and then suddenly the superstar working with the Beatles, you know. Anyway, listen, thank you for listening again. It's been another great one. I'm really, you know, I don't know who we got on next week. We got someone equally
someone
as
else.
Good.
Yeah, that was a big one. That's a big tune for sure.
You're not allowed to say that. That's copyright.
Anyway. I invented the Coverdale voice. I was doing it before Coverdale.
Oh, let's move on. It's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.